crises and tragedies in Gaza and Israel. That's the news. This episode is part of our Middle East series, in which we will soon have guests that tell the story of the Palestinian people. In this episode, my guest tells the story of the Jewish people.
So Jewish is a later term. So how would you say someone is Jewish? Again, if the Persians are a help here, they say, well, they recognize this territory that they're ruling over as Yehud because the people there must have identified as being Yehudim or Jews. But those are the ones who are living in that province called Yehud. Now, it takes a while for us to get to modern Judaism, but that's kind of even after the Second Temple's destroyed in 70 by the Romans. The Bible boasts that David created this unification, but it's called the Golden Age of Israel, the rulers, David and Solomon. Why? Because they unified. Now, prior to all this, in the period of the judges, we get the view there, and archaeology as well, that they seem to be not completely unified. They're not unified.
Oh.
They are really reluctant to come under one king. Exile occurred in 586.
586.
With the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians and, you know, the exile. Now, not everybody left, not everybody was taken, but enough went over there. 60 years later, the Persians let them go, but that community thrives. They will produce one of the most authoritative texts, the second great religious text in Judaism, which is the Babylonian Talmud. And so when do we get the derivation of Palestine, or how do we get to Palestine? Primarily, that's the Romans.
Ah.
Now, they had changed, once they had gone through a couple of revolts against the Jews, they basically outlawed Judaism in and around the area, expelled the Jews from the area, renamed Jerusalem to Elia, or Aelia Capitolina, which means, the great capital. And they basically called this area Palestine.
What does that name even mean? Where did they get that name from?
Important to know here that this is not the same people as the Palestinians today.
Did you know that the period called the Golden Age of Israel is rather short-lived, about 40 years, which ends in civil war and the split of Judah and Israel. Eventually, the Kingdom of Israel in the north is conquered by the Assyrian Empire, and the Kingdom of Judah in the south is conquered by the Babylonian Empire. Hey there, News Peelers. Today is October 20, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. On October 7, Hamas killed more than 1,400 people in Israel. And as of the recording of this podcast, Israeli airstrikes and raids have killed more than 3,400 Palestinians in Gaza, injured more than 12,000, and displaced over 1 million people. Ordinarily, I talk about the news in this section. I usually cite reports from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and other reputable sources. And I quote President Biden and other heads of states and important people. But honestly, what happened in Israel on October 7 is sheer barbarity, was so shocking to human conscience. And what's happening now in Gaza is such a calamity for the people there that I just don't feel like talking about it. Not yet anyway. It's all too fresh. Plus, I doubt that I would be sharing anything with you that you haven't already heard or seen. Instead, I want to ask some basic questions here, such as, who are the Jewish people? From what point in history did we call them Jewish anyway? When did these people begin to practice Judaism? When did they live in this land that now encompasses the modern state of Israel, Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights? And when did they leave this land? To get answers to these questions, I spoke with Dr. Michael Petlick, professor in anthropology and Judaic studies, the director of Judaic studies, and the director of the Szymaszel Center for Judaic Studies at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Dr. Petlick teaches the archaeology of Israel, God through Jewish history, written tradition of Judaism, introduction to Judaism, and monotheistic mysticism, world religions, life and legends of King David, and more. Since 2009, he has organized and led a group of Oakland University students to Israel for a tour and excavation field school. He is interested in the formation of the Israelite state, the development of the synagogue, Jewish theology, Hebrew, and the archaeology of Israel. He is very active in the Jewish community and is involved in Christian and Muslim Jewish dialogue groups. Dr. Petlick is also the current faculty advisor for the Jewish State Organization on campus and the director of the Szymaszel Center for Judaic Studies and Community Engagement. To learn more about Dr. Petlick, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode, where I've also provided a link to his dissertation on King David and also a link to a paper on the Canaanite and Judean cities of Lachish, Israel. So stay with me as Dr. Petlick and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Petlick, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
I'm excited. Thank you.
Aside from what we learn from the Bible, or for some Americans, perhaps many, what they see in the movies and TV, what does scholarship tell us about the origin of the Jewish people?
As with most things in Jewish history, I always start off by saying it's complicated. It's a long story. So I guess to take that, what I think you mean here is when can we identify the people, maybe? Okay. So we don't get the name Jew or Judaism necessarily until quite late. A little bit surprisingly late, perhaps, and that's because when the Persian Empire ruled the area, ruled the larger Eastern Mediterranean, they set up sort of governmental units called satrapies, and those were based on probably what they considered to be and what they learned to be the natives, so who was living there.
So this is the first Persian Achaemenid Empire, the one that was toppled by Alexander the Great, right?
Right. So this is around, give or take 500 BC, 400 BC. 450. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the Persian period archaeologically. And they called the place Yehud. But how do we trace that further back? We trace that further back because by then the people already knew their identity. So when we want to take it further back in time, are they Jews prior to this, the way we think of them today? The ancestors, for sure. But when we go all the way back to, say, the stories of Abraham and even David, for example, and others, they would not have said the word Jew or Jewish. You know, they may have understood Judah, meaning the place, the location, but they probably wouldn't have said that. They would have most likely said, perhaps, Hebrew, or I'm the you know, follow the sons of, you know, given patriarch, this type of thing, that type of thing. An Israelite, I don't even know if they would abuse that. But, you know, there's a certain time when now we have the name Jew, Judaism, Judah. But then again, it doesn't really become the forerunner of modern Judaism until even after in the Roman period, perhaps. So,
interesting.
Complicated.
When you use the word Yehud, I think I've even seen it on PBS from time to time when I'm just, I think I've heard this, right?
Yehudi. So today in Israel, for example, if you are to talk about a Jew, you would use the word Yehudi or okay. Yehudi, you know, for a feminine.
So would the Yehudis, that this term Yehud that came before the word Jew or Judaism, were they Jewish?
Again, it's a long process of what we look at anthropologically and historically, which is kind of where I am most expert in this stuff as far as my work. It's a process that really we can start to identify around about the year-ish 1200 BC. There's a period of time there between, say, 1200 BC and 1000 BC when a process that one Israeli scholar calls ethnogenesis occurs.
Ethnogenesis, okay.
The beginning of the identity, the traits. So in this period, if one were to say, well, what's the Bible say about this? The book of Judges is close. There's a lot of theological things going on in the book of Judges, of course, but there are some glimmers of historical sort of memory, if you will. And in that period of time, we have a number of processes that are going on in the Near East, including the arrival of the Sea Peoples, the collapse of the Middle Bronze Age kingdoms, one after another. We're starting to learn more about this. It caused a revolution insofar as government, how people in groups ruled themselves. The lack of the big city states, those had collapsed. They weren't safe anymore. So we have a sort of a revolution that way. And we also have some processes going on within what we know as Israel today with the arrival of the Sea Peoples, most notably what we know as the Philistines and others, that these small nation states are starting to come to fore. Israel seems to be quite late in that process, a little bit late. They're a little bit behind the times because they're really, really not sure about the idea of a king. They really have a hard time with this at first. But when we start to look at the archaeological remains, in this period, relatively short, 1200 to 1000, it's known as the Iron Age I in Israel. This is called the Israelite period. And we see there that they start to solidify ideas. Now, how do we know about this? We get it through textual and archaeological remains. So, for example, they start to reject the older Canaanite forms of government, how they live. What they eat is very interesting. And it seems to be that other less tangible ways of digging things up, like the idea of circumcision and other things, become relevant in this time when we look at a cross-section of the texts, the traditions, and the archaeology. So we can start to see that by a future, in the future from 1200, about 1000 BC, we have evidence of a kingdom established. And then we start to see from then on those cultural traits that had been developed over a couple hundred years really go forward and they stay in the culture all the way through. So that's why we can then say these people are the ethnogenesis of the Jewish people. Now, go ahead.
Let me peel that back for a moment, please. Ethnogenesis. And before we started our podcast conversation, I referred to some of my earlier readings, kind of vague. That's why I'm asking the question. Were they a collection? By they, I mean the Jewish people, Yehud, or the earlier name for it. Were they a collection of different peoples that converted to Judaism? Does that question make sense in this context?
So it does. It just depends on when Because the idea of a conversion in say the biblical period, it wasn't the same at all what it is, say, for today. It's much mm-hmm. different. So it really is modern Judaism, and then there's biblical Judaism. These are quite different context, quite different sort of traits, rituals, etc. Mm-hmm. But there's a core base idea. You know, the ideas propel forward in time and become enshrined within Judaism.
I see. Okay. We keep on talking about Judaism, Dr. Pitlick. For these ancient times, is it more appropriate to talk about Yahwehism?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one way to look at it. Again,
could you describe that for us, please? What is Yahweh and how does it relate to Judaism?
All right, so this is a term. It's surprisingly misunderstood, I think. And it's also one that can cause great emotion.
Emotion, okay.
Yeah. So I, for one, have learned the hard way sometimes not to use that name in, say, a formal Jewish learning context where people are coming maybe from all different backgrounds, whether they're religious or not. They have a problem with that word because we're not supposed to say it. Now,
you mean you're not supposed to utter it?
Well, here's the problem with that, because
it's sacred. Go ahead, please.
It's a sacred name that refers to the four letter name of God in the Hebrew Bible. So it's the Yud He Vav He. Yud He Vav He in Hebrew is unpronounceable. It's a name that is given to the Jewish people along the way, and it's supposed to be the name that's used for all time, according to the texts. Now, the problem is, what do we do with this name? So a lot of theology developed around this. This term, Yahweh, again, is sort of an attempt by later scholars in the more modern age to really try to understand what this word is. And so—
Does it mean God?
It refers to the idea of God, but it's more of a personal name. But again, we have to look at other contexts. When Moses first receives the name, it's not a name, it's a phrase, it's a verb in a sense. So if we were to look at the grammatical construction of Yud He Vav He in Hebrew, it's a combination of several things: the future tense, the present tense, and the past tense all together of the word to be. So really, if we wanted to talk it out, we would have to say, I will be that which I will be, which is another name given in Exodus. So, there's a great sermon, by the way. God's name is a verb, right? Means to, always be or will be, has been, forever being, forever changing, all this sort of thing. Really some good stuff there.
God's name is a verb. I'm going to have to remember that. That's profound. Okay.
Yeah. When Moses goes to Sinai and he has this interaction, this theophany with God, he gets the laws and he's supposed to go down and get them ratified by the people. Well, the people don't know this God. And so Moses says to God, who am I supposed to say sent me to them? Because if I come down with all these rules, they're not going to believe me. You know, who's sending me? And God says, tell them, I will be that which I will be sent you. Well, okay, that sounds great. And then in the Hebrew text, mixed in with Elohim and other Canaanite sort of remnants of the idea of God, we get this four-letter name. Now, Jewish tradition is very explicit. It says we cannot write it. We cannot erase it for sure. Writing means eventually it could be erased, and you don't want to blot out the name of God. That's a very strong idea. Nor can you say it. And why can't we say it? Because number one, we don't know how to say it in Hebrew because it's not a proper name like we would say, Samuel or Miriam or anything else, right? It's not one of those kind of names. It's almost impossible to say in Hebrew. That's not going to stop a modern scholar who is studying text. They're going to try to figure this out. That's how we get the idea when they look at Hebrew and they say, well, it kind of would sound like we get the words like Jehovah or Yahweh.
Oh.
That type of thing. And so scholars in the Middle Ages, theologians and others would say, we can't say it, so what do we do with it? We can't say it because you're diminishing the idea of the one creator by saying its name. You're diminishing. And you're referring to that idea. You're diminishing God, in other words, so you should not say it. So what do? We say, when we get into the text, like prayer books and such, when we see that word coming, congregations will not say it, but they will say Adonai.
Repeat that, please. They say what?
Adonai.
Which means?
Or Adoni, like the more formal way of saying Lord.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so we don't want to say, now, I have said, because in scholarship, you'll see the word Yahweh. You'll see it, because they're not so worried always about the religious perspective necessarily. They are, but they will say Yahweh. So when you ask the question, is it Yahwism? Yes, but the Hebrew Bible is always it's tricky, and it's got a lot of stuff packed in from older times and myths and all kinds of statements it's trying to make. And so while there's Yahweh or Elohim or all these other names, there's also Canaanite gods running around.
And the which really puzzles me about this period. And I want to ask a question, but I think even the words that I'm going to use for that question may be a little problematic. Let's go back to what you said. You know, Moses comes down from the mountain and people don't know this God. So he's trying to identify somehow who gave us these 10 commandments, these laws. So I want to ask this question. Let me ask it, then I'll tell you what my problem with that question is. When did Judaism become a religion? So what is my problem with that question is that I'm not even sure if the term religion makes sense for these ancient times, because I don't know, Canaanites, Elamites, Babylonians, Hittites, they all had their local gods. I'm not sure if they thought of it as religion or something else that is foreign and lost in time to us modern humans, right?
Yeah. So we have a lot of data from archaeology and from, you know, other traditions like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so it generally, in a more simplistic way of, so we can start to talk about this.
Yeah.
Religion generally is more formalized, perhaps has theological doctrine attached to it, you know, developed concepts, the rites, you know, it's a little bit more conservative. It's a little bit more narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's in these prior to Judaism, and I haven't gotten to that answer yet, when, but mm-hmm. prior in the biblical period, for example, mm-hmm. it is okay to say Yahwism, but you know, what does that include? So what we would often say is there's a cult around this. And cult is not a bad word. It doesn't mean a fringy kind of group or something like this. In the study of religions, cult, the cultus, includes everything that goes to that expression of ideas that the people have accepted. So what's part of the cult of Yahweh? Well, the Bible is surprisingly lacking in details about what they did. Now, we know they sacrificed animals, not people, sacrificed animals in high places. Those are called, you know, bamot, meaning high places. There seems to have been offerings.
By high places, you mean elevated from the ground? Is that what you mean?
Elevated hills, hilltops, okay. Sometimes raised platforms, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. Standing stones.
Mm-hmm.
These are an image that we see, not only an image, we read about the story of Jacob and others, but we have many examples in archaeology. We've dug some up. A lot of times in Judean cities, we see them in the city gate, or we see them in rooms set aside as sort of little temples within cities. We've seen a number of these at the excavations I've dug. And so what is the idea here? What goes on inside those rooms? We have a few sites that are really helpful, but the Bible doesn't say. you know, this incense stands, stone incense stands, little, what we call God boxes. That's a nickname, but little temple models with no figurines inside it, at least in the Judean context.
Interesting.
Yeah. And we have libation vessels. Now, the Bible doesn't say anything about this. And then when does it become sort of more formalized? We do see in the archaeology that some of these temple rooms in the Judean context, exactly to the point time about the King David, about 1000 BC, I've been able to dig a site for 5 years with Hebrew University that is absolutely stunning with its materials. And what we see there is that there seems to be a real concern, more so than we do today generally, in the idea of a religion. I'll just use that loosely. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in other places, we will see figurines like, in some cases, like from Baal, that are warrior figures that are left over from the Canaanites. These figurines, feminine as well, well-known goddesses from the Near East in the Canaanite tradition, Asherah, Astarte,
others. I mean, these figurines were mixed in one place, yeah, present together sometimes? Yeah, so
to my knowledge, there aren't any figurines that are supposed to be, that we know of anyway, how to read them, that are representing this Yahweh idea, because we don't have that, because they're told not to do that quite early.
Yeah.
But the Canaanite gods, goddesses, are there for various reasons. Until we get to the Babylonian destruction in 586, the exile, and when they come back, we no longer see that stuff. So Judaism gets a sort of a more formal approach when the practices go from these sort of worship elements that I just discussed to more of a text-based.
Interesting. So for a while, based on what you're saying, and correct me if I'm misphrasing or anything, what you just shared with us, for a while, people, Yahud people, Judaic people, worshipped or at least had present several forms of deity. Yahweh was not one of those figurines, but others may have been from local cultures and customs. But when the Babylonian exile occurs, when they return, that's those previous practices of sort of, I don't want to say monotheism, but sort of multiple versions of practice are erased. Now the text of Bible in and of itself.
Right. Judaism becomes a more portable religion, and the way they could do that was with the emphasis on texts.
Yeah. When they are
exiled to Babylon, the thought is because we have the progression after that of what they did with this material is they had the written texts, they write more. There's a huge community that develops in Babylon. They produce, and they're there for another 1,000+ years.
When did the Babylonian exodus occur? Exile?
Exile occurred in 586.
586.
With the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians and, the exile. BC. Not everybody left. Not everybody was taken, but enough stayed, went over there. 60 years later, the Persians let them go. But that community thrives. They will produce one of the most authoritative texts, the second great religious text in Judaism, which is the Babylonian Talmud.
Okay, you so mean what does that mean? Some Jews stayed back in Babylon.
Sizable. So it wasn't that, apparently it wasn't, it didn't prohibit them, that experience did not prohibit them from study, from textual, transmissions, and writing down the lessons of what happened before. So there's a lot of interesting turns right there. When the people come back, then they rebuild the temple because it's been destroyed. Now we have the second temple, and the sacrifices and so on continue under the Persian period and later. And the center becomes Jerusalem, and the center becomes the temple because they have no political power at this point. The Persians are in control. The Greeks are in control.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the formation of a Jewish country. We'll be back. In May 2021, Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad launched rocket attacks on Israel, and Israel carried out airstrikes in Gaza. But what rocked the region was violent clashes within Israel itself, between Israel's own people, between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews. In a televised address, Mr. Netanyahu stated that, quote, "Nothing justifies the lynching of Arabs by Jews, and nothing justifies the lynching of Jews by Arabs." And he warned, "We will not tolerate this." Back then, in 2021, Dr. Pitlick participated in our program and told us that there once was a time during which, in comparison to Jews who lived in Christian Europe, the Jews who lived in Islamic kingdoms and empires lived in relative harmony among their Muslim neighbors. Dr. Pitlick back then told us that we need to remember what we forgot. We need to remember what was once possible. I've dropped a link for you to my earlier conversation with Dr. Pitlick in Season 1, Episode 16. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Pitlick about the history of the Jewish people. Dr. Pitlick, when did the Jewish people form a polity? And we discussed some of it in the prior segment as well.
The first one we can determine, and we have some textual evidence, most notably, say, the book of Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and the 1st Kings, where we have our great hero, David.
King David.
We have Saul just before him, but the archaeology and the text don't really say Saul created a great, you know, a unified kingdom. In fact, he had a lot of problems. You know? But our big hero in this story is usually attributed traditionally to David. He established relationships with the north and with the south. So the 10 tribes of Israel, the two tribes in the south and Judah, and they combine, they become a kingdom. Now, the question is, what is the evidence for this? The Bible stories are over there by them, are here by themselves, and what evidence is there? Well, there's been enough research in the last, say, 15 years. I've been part of this for all of that time in digging up several sites in Israel to try to find if that holds. So a couple of important things to have to get straight. When should this have occurred? Because in archaeology, it's all about dating everything, right?
Of course, yeah.
So if the stories say one thing, can we really put a date to them? Well, there's a period of archaeology in Israel called Iron Age II, and it starts roughly at about 1000 BC. Internal biblical chronology, that means the text and what we can do with certain dates based on historical events, also says David should have ruled or lived right around that 1,000 years. So archaeology has a different criteria. It wants to see, what is the evidence here? What's the evidence? What's the dating? And so through a number of sites, since 2008, we have worked with Hebrew University again at a number of sites that are not in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is a very difficult place to dig, and there are lots of digs going on there, but in the countryside, sort of, just opposite known Philistine sites in antiquity, we have found a number of sites where we see evidence of urbanism. We see evidence of cultural traits that are solidified by this point. Israelite sites in this culture zone, hundreds of thousands of animal bones, very few, if statistically zero, pork bones. When we go over to the Philistine sites, in some cases, a few miles away from these other sites, the diet is there between 18 and 23% pork bones. It's a very interesting cultural divide that seems to have been really solidified once these two groups went face to face. Sometimes in war, sometimes they were living side by side, we've discovered. And so it's very interesting how that process occurred. We also have fortified cities. We have taxation. We have evidence of literacy. It's not huge, but what we do have is really compelling. So when we add all these things up, like I said, the Bible can be over here. We can say from the archaeological lens, through that lens, we can see that there is that several sites in that area, very, you know, very close together, but also dated to about 1000 BC. So we can now say we have a fledgling small kingdom.
And when you say unified kingdom, this kingdom unified brought Judah and Israel together?
Yeah, so that's the sort of the Bible boasts that David created this unification, but it's called the Golden Age of Israel, the rulers David and Solomon. Why? Because they unified. Now, prior to all this, in the period of the Judges, we get the view there, and archaeology as well, that they seem to be not completely unified. They're not unified.
Oh.
There are different sort of probably patriarchal familial groups that more or less have extended families, small territories, farms, that type of thing. They are really reluctant to come under one king. This is very true about the biblical texts. And we also get, like you mentioned a little bit before, you know, kingdoms like Edom and Aram and others, they're starting to form already. And so there's some interesting passages in the book of Judges where the people say to prophets, tell God we want a king over us like the other nations. Why? To fight our battles for us. Because the neighborhood is getting a little dicey. And they want this for this reason. And then there's a debate. Why should we have a king? The God comes back and says to them, you know what a king's going to do to you, right? He's going to make you go to wars. He's going to make you pay taxes. He's going to make you, do all these things. And guess what? That happens.
Yeah.
And so David comes along. And if you read the David story, which is fantastic, I'm teaching a class now about this whole period, or David, the text of David, you see a number of ways he did this. Now, David is a complex character, good, bad, great, sinister, all kinds of stuff. He was a good king for the 10th century in the Near East, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does he do? He marries into the north through a whole process of being very charismatic and, of course, good looking.
What do you mean he marries into the north? Explain that, please.
Okay, so Saul is sort of in the north as the sort of ruling family there.
Mm-hmm.
Got some extended reach, you know. He's got groups reporting to him. No evidence of a kingdom from the north, a northern perspective. This is within what we would see northern Israel would be today, for example. David marries into that family. His first wife is Michal. And he also, for some reason, Jonathan, Saul's son, would be next in line. Jonathan, in the textual tradition, in the literature, gives David his birthright, basically. So how that happened, it's a very interesting story itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
David does a number of things with aligning with different groups. David pulls out all the stops, and eventually, one way or another, right or wrong, he establishes a small kingdom first in Judah, in Hebron, Jerusalem, and then the tribes from the north, at least from the literary perspective, come and help. Now, how do we make sense of this, grand united monarchy? Solomon inherits the kingdom from David. Solomon has he has less problems than David did. Solomon doesn't have to fight the Philistines, for example. Mm-hmm. It's relatively peaceful. But after Solomon's reign, they split again, north and south. They fight civil wars. So this golden age of a united monarchy is fairly short-lived.
Yeah.
Now, in the north, are they the same people as the south? I don't know if that's a question that really matters so much, but we can determine, yes, they had the...
But they're both Jewish, these two peoples of the north and the south that we're talking. We're still talking about Jewish people, right?
We're talking about Israelites and Judeans.
Yes.
So okay. Jewish is a later term.
Okay.
So how would you say someone is Jewish? Again, if the Persians are a help here, they say, well, they recognize this territory that they're ruling over as Yehud because the people there must have identified as being Yehudim or Jews. But those are the ones who are living in that province called Yehud. Now, it takes a while for us to get to modern Judaism, but that's kind of even after the Second Temple's destroyed in 70 by the Romans. Then we get the interaction with Christianity and the split, and so there's a further development. The rabbis really give us modern Judaism.
Is it so? You informed us that the Persians called this area by the name, different derivations of the name Yehud. What about subsequent empires? For example, the Greeks came, the Romans came, then later Byzantium Romans came. What did they call this area?
Well,
and by area, just to sort of using modern geography, I mean current state of Israel, West Bank, Golan Heights, mm-hmm. I guess Gaza. Was this an area, or were these different, I don't know, fiefdoms, polities? Does our modern sense of geography make sense for back then?
To a point, but you know, we just have to think for a moment about the complexity of even the modern Middle East. Nobody even agrees on who belongs where today. It's confusing. I will say this though, that we don't think in this term, so we have to look back in time. So what do we have? We have territories. We have cultural borders, like I mentioned with the diet and the circumcision and all that business. We have that. And I think there would have been a strong sense that if you were in, let's say, 1000 BC or so, and you're walking to, you know, the site I mentioned that we dug up, they would say, yes, I'm a proud follower of the tribe of Israel or something like this. Or we're the subjects of David or Saul or whoever they have associated with. And if you went across the border and you went to, say, the Philistine city of Gath, they would probably say, we are proud Cypriots or something like this from where they came. You know, there are city-states. City-states control not only the little village that it was, but an area around it. And so there are different names for this. So a lot of them just go by the city names. Gat, Ekron, Jerusalem, this type of thing. But as far as an area, there are a number of different names over history. The earliest ones we have roughly go back to the Armana letters from Egypt. And there are some really great clues there because they are correspondences written over several hundred years, letters, copies of letters that were sent from Armana, which was the capital then in Egypt, to various places around the Near East that we are talking about. So they would call these places a derivation of the word Canaan. So Kana'a or Kananu or Kina'a, this type of thing. That's from the Armana letters. Now, the Egyptians also had other names for this area, generally. You know, more or less the Sinai and modern Israel today, Jordan, even parts of Syria, they called these people, the people, Asiatics.
Asiatics.
Asiatics. That's how they refer to them. And it's a derogatory term from the Egyptians. The other name they have for these people, which is a bit ironic, is sand dwellers.
Sand dwellers, they would say that to these people? Oh, wow.
Yeah. The Phoenicians have a name that's similar to Canaan, but they for this area, but they're close by. They're in, you know, southern Lebanon today and Tyre, yeah. Sidon, and some of these other places. The Assyrians called this place a derivation of the word Amuru. And so when do we get the derivation of Palestine, or how do we get to Palestine? Primarily, that's the Romans.
Ah.
Now, they had changed, once they had gone through a couple of revolts against the Jews, they basically outlawed Judaism in and around the area, expelled the Jews from the area, renamed Jerusalem to Aelia, or Aelia Capitolina, which means, you know, the great capital. And they basically called this area Palestine.
What does that name even mean? Where did they get that name from?
Important to know here that this is not the same people as the Palestinians today. Okay. So it's a derivation on the word Philistine, or the plain of Philistia, which is sort of the coastal plain in along Israel that would include part of the Gaza Strip today. Tel Aviv in that area, it's called the coastal plain or the plain of Philistia. So it's a more of a geographic. But it also is where the Philistines used to live. Now, these are not an imaginary people, and it's not just Goliath here. These are a developed society, developed culture. They have their own history. They were the remnants in all these various city-states. They were wiped out, too, by the Assyrians and others. So they're gone from history, like even the 10 tribes of Israel. They're gone over time. And so the Christians come in, and what do? In the Byzantine period, they divide up the area because they're very concerned about developing the Christian pilgrimage trade and also setting up an administration. This is a big empire too. They divide this area to three areas with the name Palestine. Palestina Prima, which is around Jerusalem. Palestina Secunda and Palestina Tertia, basically. I might have that wrong as far as the pronunciation.
Yeah.
The three-part areas of Palestine. So that stuck.
That's fascinating. And this name has more to do with the geography of coastal Israel than any of the peoples, such as the Philistines that we were talking about.
So the Philistines, their own culture, their viable culture, 600 years. But then, unfortunately, caught up with many other groups, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they basically wiped them out or displaced them. They exiled those people, too. So they're gone. A lot of time passes, and then it's only until the year 638 is the date, AD, CE, where we have the conquest by the Muslim forces.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we have a different population altogether over time, and then we end up eventually with the Palestinian people, which is a whole other thing, you know, of course.
Yeah. We'll be back after a short break to talk about Jews leaving Israel, and we'll even have to define that term in the next segment. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super-duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries, like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy, and also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Dr. Pitlick, in the prior segment, you talked about how the Jews were expelled from their homeland. What I want to know is, from what point in time, do Jews begin to leave this geographical area? And by the term leave, I'm just using it for the limited purposes of this conversation. I don't mean that term to be a defining term for what happened to them.
It occurs at different stages. So as I tell my classes, when we get to studying the Babylonian invasion and the destruction of the wider region and Jerusalem and the exile, that kind of could be the end of the story here for the Jewish people. Could have been. It's not. It has its own journey after that. The Persians allow the Jews to come back. They thrive. It's an economic boom. The Greeks come in, sort of continues. And then we have Hellenism and the Romans and so on. There are two revolts that are fought. The Jews rebel against the Roman occupation. One ends in the destruction of the temple in 70. And then there's another one about 60 years later called the Bar Kokhba Revolt from 132 to 135 CE, AD. After that, the Emperor Hadrian and others decide, we're done with this. Jews are barred from Jerusalem. Where do they go? Now, there's a sizable population at this point, but there's a sizable population of others in the area. Greeks, Romans, non-aligned, just, you know, all kinds of different people. Zoroastrians, it's a mixed bag over there. For the most part, Jews go to the coast and they go to the north, and some leave. There are big populations around this time in places like, say, for example, Rome or Sardis or Alexandria, and southern Europe, Greece, Italy, Spain, even parts of very southern France. And so there's a dispersion. They're very active. They pick up lives in those other locations. So there's always a core group there, but there's people leave for a number of reasons. Economic, they have certain skills, like today, you go and you go where there's work, or you go to big population centers where there's also centers of Jewish learning. Baghdad was one of them, or Babylon. Alexandria was another. And so, yes, some people leave, some people are expelled, but usually it's right around Jerusalem that it's the expulsion is. The people go to the north to the Galilee, and there's a whole nother history right there with the development of the Talmud and rabbis and so on and so forth. So, but there's a big diaspora already by the second and third century, even earlier.
First of all, when we think about Jews leaving the area of Israel around Jerusalem, what have you, and you know, you mentioned Rome, Alexandria, and southern France. Is this normal for that time? These are far distances. Did these sort of migrations happen?
Yeah, it's surprisingly more cosmopolitan than we might think. There's already and well established sea trade. If anything that we get from, say, the Cairo Geniza, the hundreds of thousands of documents. Now they're later. But they report a history of economics and daily life of the Near Eastern Jewish community based in Egypt, Cairo, from about 800 to upwards to the 19th century, for example. This rich trove of documents tells us there are something like 400 different trades that people were engaged in, mostly Jews, because this is the Jewish depository of texts.
Yeah, yeah.
They're trading with India.
Wow.
Going to Muslim centers and learning how to negotiate through trade or through, you know, business generally. And the problems that come from that, such as leaving for long periods of time, and who's going to take care of the estates, and the rights of women, and the rights of women in divorce, and all kinds of other things. It's fascinating. It's a much more complicated I call it the lake, you know, the big lake of the Mediterranean. Yeah.
By the way, for our audience, in my last conversation with you, it happened 2 years ago, you talked about this treasure trove of documents in the Geniza found in Jerusalem. I think it was Solomon Schechter that found it.
Cairo, but yes.
Cairo, yes. We won't get into that, but I'll provide a link to that conversation, which is really fascinating, and includes discussions of business and women running businesses, and it goes several, I think, 900 or 1,000 years back in history. Is it safe for me to sort of conclude that there was not this refugee mode of fleeing the area? And the only reason I'm using those words, because I'm using my own modern understanding of leaving an area, for example, what we saw 5, 6, 7 years ago with Syria, right? Refugees coming on boat. I guess they're still doing that from North Africa.
Right.
So it sort of happened gradually and incrementally.
Well, we get a different, we're missing big parts of the story. The average person's experience. I don't want to paint a broad painting here that this was like, okay, really advantageous to move to Alexandria and we made a lot of money and everybody was happy. You know, there are stages of this that really affect everybody. And the ones who don't get to tell their story are the ones who are like probably the average person, right?
Yeah.
When the Assyrian army comes in the 8th century in waves, this is a mighty, mighty empire with a brutal military, a very effective but yet brutal military machine. They take communities and city-states all over the Levant, not just Israel, and they displace those people. So those people have really no choice. Now, I'll just tell you how graphic.
So this is forced migration.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there is that. The Romans were not, you know, kind in some cases either, as no people is kind at all times. But I will tell you this. When we excavated a site called Lachish,
where was that?
Lachish is about 23-ish, 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. It's opposite the Gaza Strip by about 15 miles or mm-hmm. so, central Israel. Okay, so in the 1930s, when this was first excavated, the British archaeologist Leslie Starkey found there, in the side of the tell, this artificial mound, a huge sort of repository of over at least 11 to 1200 corpses or body skeletons.
Wow.
And he wrote about it and he discussed it, and he really didn't have the methods we have today, obviously, in the 1930s. But, you know, the assumption was that this might have been one of the mass exterminations that occurred during an invasion. Now, Lachish has a really solid evidence here of the Assyrian invasion in 701. It might be from that, where the men mostly were either killed or conscripted as labor, and the women and children marched off. Now, we have evidence of destruction of that city, and it wasn't pretty at all. So we have that. Now, we tried in the last years. It was covered over and never re-excavated. We tried in the last few years to try to find that at that site. We haven't really been successful. And part of the reason is that there's a whole thing about working with human remains in, you know, the Near East generally and other societies as well. So some people are just more content to leave it alone. But, you know, this was not exactly a pretty experience for these people. They don't get a voice. So archaeology gives a bit of a voice, but we don't have the whole picture. So it wasn't always pretty. And when we say forced migrations, that usually means, you know, a great deal of death and, you know, slavery and all these other things that go with it.
So I guess I should correct myself here then. My summation, my paraphrasing of what you were sharing with me about leaving Jerusalem, much of that story comes from people who successfully left, who were sort of elite. They became merchants, they rode, and they did things. There's a lot of violence and death and destruction with a lot of people whose voices we just haven't heard. They've just been lost, such as the 11 to 1200 corpses that you talked about in Lachish. Did I say that right?
Lachish, yeah.
And that site is closed off. You haven't been able to get access to it and examine.
No, just that particular, call it a grave area, you know, a deposit, a depository. We have dug the site in other places. It's a huge site. So we were just trying to see if we could find where the original place was located. We think we know, but what are we going to do? I'm not sure we're going to go back in there or anything like this. It's a very dicey thing. And we had other research plans.
Yeah. So. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Pitlick as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Pitlick, in the last three segments, as we were talking about the history of the Jewish people, going back to the original name that was one of the earlier names that was used for them, Yehud, you made many references to the Bible. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, how much of the stories in the Bible about the Jewish people, because that's what we're talking about now, are myth, and how much of them are real? Does this make your work as an archaeologist difficult?
It's a really good question. So there are several schools of thought about this. You can imagine there are people who are more on the what we call the maximalist side of things.
What does that mean, maximalist?
So the Bible says such and such happened here, this event, this person did this at this event, this type of thing. And so an archaeologist who might be a maximalist might say, that's the Bible says so. But it leads us to a problem called circular reasoning, okay? This was really a pitfall in the early days of archaeology, before the methods were really refined of dating and things like this. Archaeology is concerned with a lot of things, but when, how, and who are some of the questions.
Yeah.
Bible is interested in a different thing, and it's not an archaeological source book. It's a story of legends, and it's a story of theology, and it's a story of stories and families and wars and all kinds of stuff. So the problem with circular reasoning, say, for example, a site we probably have all heard of is Jericho.
Yeah, yeah. So
early on, the idea was that the Bible, most people thought, say at the the early beginning of the 20th century, 19th century, in that time frame, that the Bible was, it says what it says, it's true. And so when we hear this, we read the stories about, Joshua marching around Jericho and the walls fell down and all that stuff. Well, okay, an archaeologist would say, even today, maybe, well, if that is true, then we should find an evidence of destruction and the walls falling down or something like this. So they went to Jericho with this Bible story in mind early on. And they said, they dug around and they said, well, you can see it when something collapses and you can see destruction layers. And so they came to a destruction layer, and this is a simplified story. Here's the evidence of Joshua's conquest. This also occurred at places like Troy. Schliemann did the same sort of thing there, except when Schliemann found a destruction layer, it was 2,000 years earlier than the time of the Trojan War.
But he was not a trained archaeologist, right?
Right. He was a passionate historian in the Iliad and the Odyssey and was just fascinated with this story. So circular reasoning can be a real problem. Now, that's a maximalist. Bible says.
So to just finish the Jericho story, where the destroyed walls from a different era?
They were from a much different era. So Kathleen Kenyon comes along in the 1950s and says, I'll fix this story. I'll tell you. And she was well-versed in biblical history and all that stuff, but she was a great archaeologist, and the methods were much better. And she said, sorry, world, when I did this, the dating doesn't match up. So what she claimed was, at that point, she published this, and it was in the press and everything at the time. I'm sorry to say, people, that, we've done this work with these methods and so on, and that at the time of Joshua, there was no Jericho standing. So there's doesn't mean the story can't teach us something.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, a minimalist would say archaeology only, it's the only witness to history. That's Bible is later, it's full of stories, doesn't apply here. It's not history. That's a minimalist. A moderate, of course, everybody says they're a moderate today, is that the Bible is a tool, as are Assyrian inscriptions and Egyptian inscriptions. So what's interesting about this is that we're in the realm of history when we're talking about texts outside the Bible, but we're in the area of myth when we're talking about the Bible for some people. So what is it? Which one is it? So, for example, one of the more famous inscriptions, some of the most famous inscriptions are extra-biblical, means they're found outside the Bible. And they can really corroborate some great historical stuff. Like we have two inscriptions about mentioning the house of David.
This was
earth shattering when these came out, because everybody said over here with the Bible, you can't use it. And by the way, there's no fortified cities. There's no literacy at this time. Well, we proved all that wrong. We have this in the archaeology. But then when the Aramean king says, I defeated these kings, so-and-so and so-and-so, from the house of David. It's not in the Bible. It's an inscription over there from the kingdom of Aram. And, okay, so what do, you know, what do we do with this? Now, we also have one much earlier from Egyptian sources.
Yeah.
They claim there that the emperor, or the emperor, the pharaoh Merneptah says, I destroyed a people called Israel. So here's the thing about texts. They're just as, they have to be as interpreted as anything else.
They could be unreliable, self-serving.
Yeah, is that what I've heard in my own college. We have history over there. We have archaeology over here. And I've heard some of the historians say, oh, archaeology, it's all interpretation. As if text, as if text are the same thing. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I take it that in these, in this wide spectrum from maximalist to minimalist, you are a true moderate? Of course. There you go. Point of clarification, in a prior segment, you said archaeology in Jerusalem is very difficult. Is that because of ethnic and political tensions, or is it just because it's a big city, it's hard to dig? It would be hard to do archaeology in the middle of San Francisco.
Exactly. So yesterday, as a matter of fact, in a class, I said, let's use the analogy. We're talking about the very same thing, the very same topic. And I said, imagine, because we're in the Detroit area, I said the class, can you imagine you're given the task to go to Metro Detroit and find evidence of the French, you know, occupation or French presence in the city of Detroit? Where are you going to go?
Start digging streets, pavement.
I see. That's the problem. Number one, it's urbanized and it has been for thousands of years. It's also politically charged, of course. It's got three, at least, great religions who have different ways of interpreting the value of archaeology.
Yeah.
So certain parts are off limits. Certain parts are, yeah, welcome, come dig, because the more you tell us, the more it helps us with telling a historical story. So there's different viewpoints on this. And there's also, you know, modern political problems, of course. We can't, archaeology is involved in these, whether we want to be or not.
Yeah, in a way, archaeology is politicized in these contexts as well.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So it just depends on how one views the role of archaeology and whose interpretations you can believe. Can you imagine trying to explain, you know, the, you know, if you're a non practicing something or another and you're trying to dig up their history, I mean, it just gets very complicated.
Yeah. Do you have any lessons, takeaways for our audience? You know, we talked about an hour about the history of the Jewish people and we went really far. We stayed away from all the politics and events that are occurring now.
Takeaways, I don't know if I have any, you know, brilliant points, takeaways. I think that what's really fascinating is that we should also keep an eye on the fact that for good long periods of time, there was cooperation, there was cohabitation, there was interchange of ideas. And I think some of the lessons of history, including the Middle Ages, when they are talking about commonalities among three great faiths, and in the Near East, two great faiths, Judaism and Islam, they are really getting on together with talking about ideas. And I have experienced that myself in the Detroit area when I work with interfaith groups for the Jewish-Muslim dialogue. When we talked about our common stories, it changed the entire environment. And then we could start to be safe in that environment.
Do you also talk to this interfaith exchange? Does it take place in difficult times such as ours now as well?
It becomes a little bit more guarded for sure.
Yeah.
But it's also important to keep this going. And when we start to look at the stories that we have different inflections, we can say your story says this and our story says this. And then we can see how they match or how they don't, or what's interesting to learn over here. I think, you know, it's really a tragic thing if we just look at the negative.
And
it's hard not to right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's some great lessons about the, you know, not only that, but the resiliency of people.
For sure.
They didn't have a grand government in these pre-modern periods to, you know, to help them. They are extremely knowledgeable. They're extremely skilled. And I'm not just talking Jews, and, you know, I'm talking about everybody in this period, because mm-hmm. they had to be.
Yeah. There was no UN or no great powers from North America or Europe or whatever, Far East, coming to help and intervene, perhaps.
And one last thing I would say is, if we think we know, we probably don't. So I think we need to also allow each other great leeway and also, you know, sift through this stuff and see what really is relevant and not sensationalized.
That's wonderful. Dr. Pitlick, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much, Dr. Pitlick.
Thank you so much.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.